hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Just how long the rest of us can count to be free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and fought and died. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you run down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program. Here on White Resistance Radio. .com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, here's a company I have a few shares in. It's called Lithium. And I get the... the shareholders report prior to the annual shareholders meeting. And I'll tell you, some of the people in big in business are, you know, absolutely swilled with the politically correct Kool-Aid. Here's a section in the report called Diversity. The company has significant assets and operations in both North and South America, and this geographic breadth is further complemented by regional and local diversity. As such, Lithium, this company, enjoys a multifaceted and multicultural workforce that brings a wide array of experience, knowledge, background, culture, and heritage to the business. Is a wide variety necessarily good? I don't know. Well, they're going to say it is. Diversity encompasses the varied characteristics that make individuals unique from one another, whether that is by gender, ethnicity, age, race, religion, disability, cultural and social socioeconomic background, nationality, sexual orientation, language, educational background, or experience. So what exactly are they saying? These various characteristics make people different, okay? Diversity encourages varied perspectives and an enhanced ability to critically evaluate how the company operates and interacts with various stakeholders. That is a big act of faith. Sometimes a wide variety of everything simply creates chaos. And then they continue. While gender is only one aspect of diversity, it's an emerging area of focus for the company. Mining has historically been considered an industry with few opportunities for women for a variety of reasons. Among other consequences, the mining industry has not been regarded as an attractive career choice for women. And this further perpetuates the traditionally low representation of female employees and leaders. Although we have a high level of female employees at the corporate level, we seek to effect an increase in the number of women holding senior leadership roles through to the board level. They're stuffing more women on the board. Well, this may seem a little harsh. I might note, though, that their shares are not doing that well right now. Now, is that because they have a disproportionate number of women? I'm not saying that. I don't know. But I see organizations, corporations, putting a lot of emphasis on diversity. And I don't see a lot of return from it. If diversity is only a way of achieving diversity is accomplished by putting people in solely because of their sex or their ethnicity or whatever. I think, especially with board of directors, that they're the ones who guide the company. You really want talent. I'm not saying they don't have the talent. I'm just saying that I find the emphasis on diversity a real problem. Well, the coronavirus pandemic has led, in many cases, and I argue this, to something pretty close to a police state. Yeah, I mean, that's what we are approaching now, something like a police state. Where police are now enforcing social distancing, not being in parks. Well, that's kind of up in the air whether you still have the right to be in the park. Hey, it's our park; we pay for it. It's a very unhealthy time. Well, here's a story from my own city. I can't pay it anyway. Why are Hamilton police ticketing homeless residents during the COVID-19 pandemic? Rick Dixon is regularly sleeping rough rather than visiting homeless shelters that he fears could expose him to a case of COVID-19 he might not survive. Now, that sleepy rough is another way of saying sleeping outdoors. That might not be too bad if you're an American in the South, but we have had an unseasonably cold April. Tonight it's going to go down to freezing in Hamilton. Not a swift idea, though I certainly understand his point. I fought cancer. I get pneumonia twice a year. If I get the coronavirus, I'm probably dead, said the 49-year-old. Who uses a walker to get around and is missing a large piece of his skull following surgery to remove a tumor. Now, this guy is not in good condition, obviously. Dixon says he understands the pandemic lockdown, even as it makes his life on the street that much tougher with the closure of meal programs and warm hangout spaces like the library or coffee shops. Now, that's another problem with the shutdowns of most public buildings, libraries, art galleries, etc. But he doesn't understand why police bothered to hand him an $880 ticket on April 3rd for breaching a provincial order against gatherings of five or more people. The pandemic order is meant to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. A ticket is $750 plus 130 victim fine surcharge. So this is the ultimate, you know, just knee in the kidneys. 130 victim fine surcharge. What victim? This poor guy's the victim. There's no victim he has to compensate. This is just thuggery. Dixon said he was sitting near the downtown Urban Core Health Center that afternoon when he got the ticket. There were people nearby, but he didn't consider himself part of the group. I can't pay it anyway. They know that. I feel like they're just harassing me. And he said the officer said, well, he was just doing his job. Yeah. I like to point out when I hear that or something similar, oh, I'm just following orders. I like to say this, and half the time they're so dumb they don't even get it, but I said, well, you know, that did get them off at Nuremberg. You know, a number of the people who were, I mean, and this was a kangaroo court, but a number of people said, who were defendants, said, well, you know, I was only following orders, which is quite, it was true. But that didn't absolve them. It should have, but it didn't. Okay. Ticketing homeless people should not be part of the pandemic policing job, according to a coalition of medical outreach groups and community Hamilton Community Legal Clinic. The group of healthcare workers and lawyers called on police this Monday to stop ticketing homeless individuals who stay in the same shelters, proposing there is a legal argument that shared close living quarters effectively make those individuals part of the same household. Regardless, each ticket represents 2 months of income for a homeless person on welfare and will likely never be paid. The clinic lawyer Sharon Crow, said, I think everybody recognizes the futility of that action. I'm hoping we can get police and the bylaw on board. You know, this is one of the things that goes out in a situation like that, and that is common sense. What is the point of giving this homeless guy an $880 ticket? He can't pay it. He doesn't have any money. If he had money, he wouldn't be homeless. And $880 might be a month's rent for a room. Maybe even a bit more than that. He doesn't have that. How is he going to pay it? You know, there's a lack of common sense in this. Also, a fine that somebody cannot possibly pay is hardly a deterrent anymore. It's a deterrent if the fine is something you can pay and it hurts and it might make you say, conclude, well, I better not do that again, whatever it was that led to the fine. This just doesn't make any sense. Far more sensible would be if the officer in question really thought there was a problem, people bunching together, to go over and say, look, guys, you know, there is this rule against any gathering of more than five persons. Perhaps a few of you could move a little bit further apart. Wouldn't that be the sensible thing to do? But I see us really hurtling in the direction of a police state. Oh yes, I've mentioned this before, but I was again this afternoon on the Lincoln Alexander Parkway, and that is a parkway that runs down the east side of the city of Hamilton and allows you to get from one end of the city to another fairly quickly. Well, it has, I believe, three lanes in each direction, and in the middle there's a grass median. Well, probably for every time in the last couple of weeks that I've driven on the Lincoln, with maybe one exception, there has been a police car lurking, presumably to jump out and give you a speeding ticket. Now, what good does that do? You know, they're speeding, If some car is going 50 miles an hour over the speed limit and, you know, is weaving up and down the road, yeah, sure, that's dangerous driving. But the speed limits on the Lincoln are artificially low, as is often the case with roads and highways in Ontario. This is simply what they say in Appalachia, or call in Appalachia, revenueing. This has nothing to do with law and order, safe driving, or anything like that. It's just a matter of raising shekels. Now, look at the time. We're now in an era that within the last 3 weeks, Canada's unemployment rate has soared to 3 million. Well, let me put this in perspective. It could well be moving up to over 20% of the workforce. I don't mean people who've been told to stay at home. I mean people who have lost their job. Now, there's a very good chance that many of the people driving on the Lincoln Alexander Parkway are in that category. They've just lost their job. Now, is slapping them with a huge fine, is that really conducive to an orderly society? Or is it just bullying and parasitism? Well, in my opinion, it's bullying, parasitism, and just dumb policing. But I think we're going to see more of that. Well, I'm going to play something by Tucker Carlson, a very recent broadcast of his that I thought was particularly interesting and worthwhile. And it deals with the very important question of, well, how many people are actually dying? We do know that about 3 weeks ago, the Premier of the province of Ontario scared himself, and I'll assume he was being honest. I don't have a reason to think that this was a con. It might have been a con, but I think he honestly believed the projections he was showing. Now, you've got to understand that these projections are only that. They talk about them being based on modeling. Well, you can set up a model to the model is only as good as the assumptions that it makes. Anyway, the model that the Premier was sold on said that we could face anywhere between 3,000 and 15,000 deaths in the province of Ontario by the end of April. We were told there could be as many as, 800,000 cases in a province of about 14 million people. It should be a significant number. Now, of course, even if that was true, most people do not get very sick from the coronavirus. Only about 80% feel they've got, to one degree or another, a bad cold. And in some cases, almost no symptoms at all. Of those, about 20% have fairly serious symptoms, some of which may actually land them in hospital. Okay, so not good, but even at the worst case scenario, when you reduce it like that, you see it's not as bad as you were told. Well, okay, what's the reality? Well, we are 1 week from the end of April. It's not between 3,000 and 15,000 deaths in Ontario. We have had, I believe, about 500. Now, that's not, I mean, that's not to be sneered at, but far, 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 far less. Oh, yes, and we were told that almost certainly there would be 80,000 cases by the end of April in Ontario. We have under 20,000. Now, part of one reaction to that is, well, that's good news. And yes, it is good news. You know, better than certainly the opposite. However, it raises the question of, well, how good were these projections? These projections that have led to I won't say the complete shutdown of the province, but very considerable damage to the economy. And so I think it becomes really important to know the exact numbers, because we've been told wild stories of what might be. Well, that's why I find this item by Tucker Carlson quite interesting.
One of the scariest things about the Wuhan coronavirus, one of the main reasons all of us have long been so afraid of it, has always been how little we know about it. Ebola, malaria, cholera, obviously those are dangerous diseases that killed millions. But on the whole, we understand them pretty well, the fundamentals anyway. Anyway, we know how easily they spread. We know how deadly they are. This disease, by contrast, is entirely new. It's literally a novel coronavirus. Early accounts said the mystery illness coming from central China could be transmitted far more easily than the flu, and that the death rate was remarkably high. Some reports suggested it could kill 2, 3, 5, even 8% of all those who got it. Worst case scenarios predicted millions and millions of people would die. The public was horrified. They still are. But how afraid should they be? Many people are still dying in this pandemic, including here in the United States. Beyond that fact, we still don't have the numbers we need to fully understand what's happening around us. Too few people have been tested. And yet, as of tonight, there are some suggestions of good news we want to bring them to. Here's one. Between March 22nd and April 4th, a total of 215 pregnant women delivered babies at New York Presbyterian Allen Hospital and Columbia University Irving Medical Center. Every single one of these women was screened for the coronavirus. It turned out that 33 of them had it. That's more than 15% of the total group. Of the infected, 29 of them, that's about 88% of them, were totally asymptomatic. So think about what that might mean if we extrapolated it citywide. As of April 4th, New York had more than 60,000 confirmed cases of the coronavirus and a little over 2,200 deaths. If more than 15% of New York's population was infected, that would suggest a total of 1.3 million cases in New York, with only about 150,000 of them showing symptoms. In other words, the virus would be far more widespread than we expected it to be, but also far less deadly than we expected. The actual death rate would not be 3 or 4%, it would be closer to 0.2%. That would be great. Now, we don't know for certain that's the case. 215 people is a small sample, and in this specific case, it's not a representative sample. Hospitals are major vectors for the transmission of coronavirus. Pregnant women tend to spend a lot of time in hospitals. Pregnant women are also younger and healthier than most people, so it's possible they're also less likely to exhibit symptoms of the virus. We don't know. On the other hand, this is not the only study that suggests these trends. In Scotland, researchers tested 500 people 3 weeks into the outbreak there. More than 1% tested positive for antibodies to coronavirus. That is 12 times greater than the confirmed caseload in that country at that time. 12 times more. In Denmark, a little over a month into the outbreak, only 0.1% of the population was infected, according to official numbers. And yet a screening of 1,500 people found that 2.7% actually had antibodies. That would mean the true death rate from coronavirus there might be 1/27th as high as they thought it was. Meanwhile, in Germany, the official death rate from the coronavirus stands today at about 2.5%. That's a horrifying number. And it may be real. On the other hand, in the town of Gengelt, where large-scale random testing has been performed, the death rate was found to be just 0.37%. That's a fraction of the official numbers, barely 1/7th of it. So all of this is very encouraging news. If the infection is more widespread than we thought, by definition, that means the virus is less deadly. That would mean our burden on the healthcare system would be lower than we expected it to be. And in fact, we are seeing that. It would also mean that coronavirus may be closer than we knew to running its course. It would mean an awful lot of people have already been infected with it and then recovered without even knowing it. And those people could pause and let relief sweep over them and then get back to their lives. Above all, if this is true, if these trends hold, it would mean that the rest of us could be slightly less terrified going forward. Yes, this is awful. Yes, people are dying. Yes, they will continue to die here in the U.S., but it would not quite be the plague we thought it was. And that might give us some perspective. We could begin maybe to think clearly again. Most of us want all of that badly, but do our leaders want that? Sometimes when you watch them, you begin to suspect they're secretly enjoying our fear. Dr. Jay Bhattacharya is a Stanford University medical professor. He's been investigating the death rate from coronavirus, a fascinating and important number, and he joins us tonight. Doctor, thanks so much for coming on. What are you concluding about the real death rate, the actual death rate from this virus?
I think based on the evidence I've seen so far, it's likely orders of magnitude lower than the initial estimates. The World Health Organization put an estimate out that was, I think, initially 3.4%. It's very unlikely that it's anywhere near that. It's much likely, much closer to the death rate that you see from the flu per case. But the problem, of course, is that we don't have a vaccine, so in that sense, it's more deadly and more widespread than the flu.
Right.
And it overwhelms hospital systems in ways the flu doesn't. But per case, I don't think it's as deadly as people have thought.
I know it's very hard to come up with any kind of firm numbers in the absence of widespread testing, but do you think it's likely that there are large numbers of Americans who've been infected, recovered, and didn't know it?
Yes, I believe that is true. In fact, we're going to start to know that very, very soon. I've been working on studies with some colleagues of mine in Santa Clara County, in Los Angeles County, and then also a large nationwide study working with Major League Baseball employees, not just athletes, but all the employees. Very soon, we're going to have a much more accurate understanding of how widespread this is. And as you said it very well in your introduction, we'll also know much better how deadly it actually is. Evidence from around the world is flowing in, and it's really seems like there's many, many cases of the coronavirus that we haven't identified with the testing regimens that we've had around the world. Many orders of magnitude more people have been infected with it. I think that we realize, and that as you rightly pointed out, means that the death rate is actually lower than people realize, also by orders of magnitude.
So one of the destructive byproducts of this pandemic is fear, which is itself, I would say, it clearly is hurting people. You're an American, in addition to a physician and a researcher. Based on the research that you have done, are you more afraid or less afraid than you were when you began?
I'm less afraid than I was when I began. I've heard so many stories of people who can't hug their grandkids, which are scared to hug their, because they don't want to get the virus from their kids as they're older. I've heard lots of stories of even of like husbands and wives that won't hug each other because the wife is a nurse and the frontline worker. I think this sort of understanding really the true death rate, if the death rate is somewhere near 1 in 1,000, would you not hug your wife? I mean, if it's 3 in 100, you act very differently than if it's 1 in 1,000. So I'm hoping once we get accurate numbers in place, we'll be able to really sort of quell the fear that's out there.
Boy, that is one of the most reassuring things I've heard in a long time. Doctor, thank you truly for coming on tonight. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Well, Tucker Carlson. I thought a extremely good and thoughtful approach to some of the key figures, and these are key figures in trying to come up with a sensible response. It's all about us. I'm telling you, at times it's difficult not to be a little bit critical of Jewish organizations. Here's a report, so this is the page all about the coronavirus around the world. Report, crisis stoking anti-Semitism worldwide. Now, listen carefully to this, and ask yourself, does this correspond to the world you know? Dateline Jerusalem, the coronavirus crisis is stirring anti-Semitism around the world, fueled by centuries-old lies that Jews are spreading infection, researchers in Israel stated on Monday. Now, in all the chatter online, if you've been following it as I have, or in the lamestream media or on CNN or the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, have you ever heard in the last 3 months when there's the coronavirus story began to develop, anybody saying it's the Jews that are spreading it. Even among people, I hate to use the words conspiracy theory, but perhaps people who tend to blame Jews a lot for things, not necessarily wrongly, but I've seen virtually nobody saying somehow the Jews are doing this. Well, I'll tell you one good reason. The Jews seem unusually susceptible to this thing. So, unless you want to argue, well, they're very clever. They're poisoning themselves in order to hurt other people. You know, at this point, we're already walking into madness. But I feel really angry when I read this item, because I think you just want to somehow make a big play for sympathy, and you don't deserve any on this one. Well, anyway, the story goes on. The findings in the annual report of anti-Semitism worldwide by the Cantor Center at the Tel Aviv University showed an 18% increase in anti-Semitic incidents in 2019 over the previous year. Now, when did the coronavirus begin? Well, in terms of publicity in the West, it began somewhere in January. We know now that it was detected sometime in late November, and the Chinese spent the better part of 6 weeks trying to suppress this information, or deny it, or minimize it. But this is a report about anti-Semitism in 2019. There wouldn't be anybody around blaming the coronavirus that nobody had ever heard of, or almost nobody had ever heard of, in December on Jews or anybody else. Now, this is just crackpottery. In the first few months of 2020, far-right politicians in the United States and Europe and ultra-conservative pastors have seized upon the health crisis and its resulting economic hardship to foster hatred against Jews, the reporter said. Really, who? Who's done that? I'm not aware of any politician, far right or otherwise. Quote, the language and imagery they use clearly identifies a revival of the medieval blood libels when Jews were accused of spreading disease, poisoning wells, or controlling the economies. Moshe Kantor, president of the European Jewish Congress, said during the report's release. Frankly, I don't even know what the guy's talking about. And actually, the blood libel wasn't about poisoning wells or spreading disease. It was about ritualistic murder of little children, little boys particularly. And again, who's talking about this? This is shameless victimology. And I think they and others have to be called on it. You're not victims in this. Nobody's blaming you. And I don't like to use this term, so that I'm not saying this on my own behalf, but the Jews. Nobody's blaming them for the coronavirus. If anybody, it really is to be blamed, it's the communist Chinese government, or a bit more generally, filthy habits followed by some Chinese in terms of the eating and storing in markets of live wild animals. You know, if anybody's being blamed about that, it's them. I've read nothing and heard nobody say, oh, it's the Jews that are doing it. One of the ways, especially in Canada, that the Jewish lobby has been quite successful in getting their own way on a number of things, it has been their ability to market, hold themselves forth as victims. You know, it's a powerful guise, especially in putting things over on Christians and Anglo-Saxons. We're uniquely susceptible to a sob story, especially if somebody can portray themselves as a victim. And I'm in the process of writing a book about Canada's the sad state of free speech in Canada, and a part of the story, of course, is our hate laws, so-called hate laws. Well, Jews were able and continue to be able to get these type of laws enacted and supported by doing the We're the Victim, or A Victim Act, you know. And it's just plain ridiculous, non-factual. Jews are not victims in Canada. Jews are the wealthiest individual ethnic or religious group in Canada. Now, it's pretty hard to be a victim, you know, if you're that wealthy. You know, you might point to certain groups that are marginalized or poor, then you might be able to make a case that they're victims, but no, not really. Jews have an incredibly powerful place in Canadian society, wildly overrepresented in the media, in the legal profession. In fact, at one point, we have 9 people on our Supreme Court, 4 of them were Jews. Now, this is hardly a vulnerable minority. And they've got to be called on that. Anyway, here's some interesting news, good news. I should have actually let off of this. Last night, President Trump tweeted that he would like to see, in fact, he's going to sign an executive order to stop all immigration temporarily to the United States. This is great news. I hope he goes through with it all the way. It will begin, I hope, to stop, to break the dependency. You know, if we're ever going to get control of immigration and get control of the borders and stop the replacement of the European founding settler people of this country, a moratorium is necessary. Oh, okay. Irregular border crossings down since the shutdown. This is Canada. The federal public safety minister says fewer than 10 asylum seekers, that's illegals, have been turned back at the U.S. Border since the shutdown about a few weeks ago. Bill Blair provided the figures to the House of Commons on Monday, noting that it's been almost a month since the Canada-U.S. border was closed to all but non-essential travel in order to curb the coronavirus. Figures, people who now show up and say, I'm a refugee, are being turned back. And isn't it interesting? Once it becomes obvious that you're not going to scam your way into the country this way, they stop coming. This should have been done 50,000 illegals ago, 3.5 years ago. Chris Sully writes a column today called Reasonable Canadians Must Show Solidarity Against Snitching. And I couldn't agree more. The city of Toronto, or the leadership of which seems to have gone certifiably bonkers, have set up a COVID-19 snitch portal online. He says this is the latest insult in a spree of bizarrely misanthropic behavior from some of Canada's biggest municipal governments. People are actually being encouraged to phone 311 and rat out their fellow citizens. Not only is this going to create a great deal of ill will, it's going to be an unfair burden on the police, because a lot of people don't know it violates the regulations. In fact, many people, I don't know entirely what violates the regulations. On the obvious end, because there's a limit of grouping of 5 people unless you're the same family, if somebody, let us say, in this frigid weather, actually threw a lawn party and there are 20 people on their front lawn, and the front lawn is small, they're all close together, yeah, that would apparently be violating the regulations. Should the police be, should somebody rat people out about that? Wouldn't it be better simply to go over to the neighbors and say, hey, I think you're kind of a little numerous here. People, when they see the lineups that we're facing here just to go do your shopping, are talking in terms of a communist society. We align, had the lineup for everything. And I don't think the comparison is entirely over the top. A society where people are encouraged to snitch on each other. And human nature being what it is, much of the snitching is going to be extremely petty. Either a person who is a troublemaker, a busybody, or somebody who just has a grudge against a neighbor. Hey, what better way to shake things up than to make a phone call and the cops presumably will come running, and then they will be the neighbors, even if nothing beyond that happens, will be embarrassed and inconvenienced. This is, I think, an extremely bad result of this fighting the coronavirus. And President Trump asked a question a few weeks back that I think is kind of profound. And he said that we run the risk that the cure may be worse than the disease. Well, this is Paul Frum. Let's have something a little bit more cheerful. I'm going to play some German bar music, drinking music. Hope you like it. This is Paul Frum. You are on listening to altrighttv.com or whiteresistanceradio.com. You can get to us from either on either site and or using either handle.
Yeah.
From you're on the fighting side of me. My song up tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on Alt-Right TV or WhiteResistanceRadio.com.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here made wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together. The thistle, shamrock, rose, and wine, the maple leaf forever. homes and loved ones dear firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the Maple Leaf forever. Forever.